Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning. Welcome to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. Today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. We're streaming live, by the way, if you want to call your friends and tell them, on biz1190.com. So check us out there. Today's program is about, I had entitled it, Your Career and Your Life. And honestly, when I had planned the program, I was originally going to talk about, or at least focus on the idea of a career and life balance, which is always a good discussion. But as I was preparing for the program, it sort of morphed a little bit away from that into just the idea of how careers start and how you get into a career and the various ways and the myths that we all have about that and some realities. And I think it'll be an interesting program for you today. I want to start off with a story. There's a friend of mine named Peter Burke wrote a really good book called A Better Way to Make a Living and a Life. And in that, he actually does talk a lot about it. A lot of that book has to do with balancing a career and life and so forth. It's a great book. In the very beginning of Peter's book, he has a little story that's interesting to me. He talks about that in this small Italian village on the Mediterranean Sea, there was a man lived there. It was a very good fisherman. And every day he would go out and catch fish in the morning. He would come back in, sell that fish to the local merchants there in this town, and then spend the afternoon playing chess or something with his friends and drinking wine. That's what he did every day. And one time an American was down there and noticed this and became friends with a guy. And he said, you know, you are an outstanding fisherman. He said, you know, you can catch fish when no one else can. He said, we could expand this operation a little bit here. He said, you know, we could expand the operation and you could teach other people how to fish the way you do. We could have a lot of boats. We could bring them in here. We could, set up a distribution network and sell these fish all around the world for the kind of fish you catch and the way it works. And it would work out great. He said, I'm sure it'd be a fantastic business. He said, if we could do this 20 or 25 years, at the end of that time, you could literally sell this business for a lot of money. And then you could spend your afternoons just playing chess and drinking wine with your friends. Well, the whole story of that is that's what he was already doing. And a lot of us do sort of approach our careers with the idea with a view and a perspective that perhaps we should look at a little better. So what's really important to you? How do you visualize it? And what do you plan to do? It is amazing to me how many people are unhappy in their careers. And I have a friend that said, had a friend for some years, a doctor. And he told me several times he hated his job. And I was always taken aback by that. Like, you're a doctor. How can you hate your job? I mean, there are people that would die to have your job. I mean, you have this prestigious job of being a doctor. And, a job that a lot of people admire, look up to, you make a lot of money, all that. And he said, but I don't like the job. Well, isn't it interesting that someone could do that much preparation and that kind of discipline study and so forth and pass all the board exams and all that kind of thing to be a doctor, and yet in the end find out they don't like being a doctor? There was a guy named Cal Newberg that wrote a book. Pull it up here because I can't remember exactly. Maybe I would get it right. They wrote a book called So Good They Can't Ignore You. His name was Cal Newport, by the way, not Newberg, Cal Newport. And in that book, he relates a little episode of where he heard Steve Jobs speak at a Stanford university commencement speech to the graduating class there. And Jobs addressed this large crowd. And he offered him the following advice. He said, you've really got to find out what it is that you love. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle. And then he got a standing ovation for saying that. Well, Cal went back and after hearing that, he was doing a little research anyway on careers and so forth. And what he began to find out was that although Jobs had given that advice to the college student, he hadn't exactly, it wasn't exactly matched up with his career, his own career, and the way he did things. Steve Jobs, a guy that we all look up to, a guru, of course. And Cal Newport called it passion, the passion hypothesis. And here's what that says. It's a common thing. You all hear this. And here's what it means in a nutshell. And we've all sort of bought into this, I think, in some way. Is the key to occupational happiness is to first figure out what it is you're passionate about and then find a job that matches that passion. Now, that's a widely held belief in our society, isn't it? And we're sort of bombarded with it a little bit. And we kind of lionize and we follow those that have courage to follow their passion, as Newport says. And we pity people who sort of conform and don't follow passions and instead take, you know, what we considered mundane jobs and sort of take a safe path. You know, the idea of do what you love, find out what you love, do what you love, and the money will follow. And that's a sort of a motto, isn't it, of modern career. But as Newport points out, there's a problem there. And the problem is when you get past all those kind of bumper sticker slogans and you look down into the details of how passionate people like Steve Jobs and other people like that really got started, or ask the behavioral scientists that have studied these things what actually predicts workplace happiness, the issue gets more complicated because you begin to find just little things that don't quite match up in that, to the point that follow your passion can perhaps sometimes be rather terrible advice. And Jobs, he goes on to research Jobs a little bit. This is interesting, and this is not a show about Steve Jobs, but this may apply. This may ring true with you. Jobs, as a young man, fresh in college, was attending a liberal arts college in Oregon. Reed College, and he was not exactly Mr. Student there. He was kind of dabbling around in Western history and dance and sort of studying Eastern mysticism. He didn't seem to be particularly interested in either business or electronics as a student there. He dropped out of college after 1 year and kind of hung around doing nothing, actually taking his meals in a Hare Krishna temple there, just sort of a bum. And when he finally got sort of tired of that life, he moved back home with his parents and in California, and he got himself a night shift job at Atari. And he wasn't a very good employee there either. He split his time between working for Atari and spending his time at a commune there. And in fact, he left there after several months to make a spiritual journey, as he called it, through India. And on returning home, he began to train very seriously at the Los Angeles Zen Center. Now, we're going to talk about somebody that we're really going to follow their passions. Jobs would have followed, probably would now be a teacher, would have ended up being a teacher at the Zen Center there in Los Altos. But after he returned back in 1974 from there, a local engineer and entrepreneur there named Alex Comrade, he formed a computer time-sharing company. Is called a Call-In Computer. And he, Comrade, approached a guy named Steve Wozniak to design a terminal device, design a little terminal device that he could sell to clients so they could access his central computer. Now, unlike Jobs, Wozniak was a true electronics passion guy. He was really one of the first nerds around. He really was an electronics whiz, sort of obsessed with technology, really. And on the other side, though, Wozniak didn't like dealing with business details, and he was friends with Jobs. So he asked Jobs to handle the details of this arrangement, but where he was going to build these little terminal things for the calling computer company. And that was all going well until Jobs took off and left for an entire summer to go spend time in a commune right in the middle of this deal. And unfortunately, he failed to tell his boss, Mr. Comrade, he was leaving. And so they basically fired him. And the reason that story is kind of interesting, because that is hardly a predictor of somebody that's going to be passionate and successful in business, is it? If you were just reading that story, and I stopped right there, you would probably say that guy's a loser who's never going to make it, or at least he's not ever going to be much in business. The dude can't keep a job. He's totally unfocused. He's undisciplined. He takes off and just runs off and leaves a job. He certainly has no particular interest in technology. And that would do it. Also, you might even say the guy was a little on a flaky side. But it was later on that Jobs stumbled into a big break. He noticed that the local nerds, wireheads as he called them, were excited about the introduction of computer kits you could buy, put your own computer kits together. So he went to Wozniak and said, hey, why don't we, or you actually, since you know how to do this, why don't you design one of these little kits, because Wozniak knew how to build a computer. Why don't you design one of the kit computer circuit boards, the circuit board. You design the circuit boards. And the initial plan was, they worked it out, they could make them for $25 a piece. They would sell them to a local hobby shop there for $50, and they wanted to sell 100. And so that would have net them about $1,500 in profit. And would leave about $1,000 in profit, I should say. And neither he nor Wozniak left their jobs. This was strictly a low-risk venture meant to stir up a little extra money. I'll continue that story in just a minute after the break. By the way, you're listening to Eddie Mayfield. This is Driven to Business. Don't go anywhere. More to come. Welcome back to Driven to Business. Eddie Mayfield here. Glad that you're with us today. Before the break, I was talking about the idea that passion means everything. In other words, if you find what you're passionate about and get it done, that you're going to be fine. Again, what Cal Newborg calls the passion hypothesis, which is widely believed by many of us, isn't it? The idea that if you just find what you're passionate at doing and do it, soon the money will follow. But like many things in life, there's nuances to it. It's not that passion isn't important. It's just that there are nuances to it. We were telling a story of Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and how that they had come up with this idea after, particularly on Jobs' part, of being a very kind of almost a flaky, pretty much, I guess you could say a pretty failed employee in many ways. The idea that he began to notice that people were buying computer kits from local hobby shops. So the idea was he was used Wozniak, who was pretty much a technical genius at that time. He could build the little circuit boards. They'd build them for $25 a piece. They'd sell them for $50 and make a few. They thought they'd clear $1,000 on the deal. And that was their career plans at that point, $1,000. They wanted to do that. But when he got down there to the computer shop where he wanted to sell them, the guy told him he really wasn't interested in buying standalone circuit boards. He did say, however, that he wanted to buy fully assembled computers, and he'd pay them $500 a piece if they could do that. So they jumped at the opportunity because they were looking to make more money, and they began scrounging together enough, borrowing enough money to buy the parts they needed to get this done. And it was in that unexpected little windfall there that Apple Computer was born. Almost an accident, you would say. Certainly not driven by somebody that had a passion for electronics or a passion for business and just, you know, had these grandiose ideas of a major, major, major company, and he just wanted to, and he just drove that passion into success. It's almost like he sort of fell into it at least into the opportunity. Now, this is not being disdainful of any of their later accomplishments. Or what I'm saying is the beginning, though. I don't think Jobs had much of a passion for either business or electronics until he began to taste the success of this first little Apple job right there. And we all get to do that. You know, and when it comes to finding fulfilling work, fulfilling career, the details matter, don't they? You know, if Jobs had taken his own advice that he gave the Sanford guys to find what he loves and pursue that, again, he would probably have been teaching at a Zen temple somewhere. That's what he was passionate about. At least that's the most passion he seemed to have for anything. But instead, almost a lucky break sort of fell his way. And to his credit, I'm not one of those guys that think, I don't think you luck into success entirely. But sometimes circumstances do line up for you. And then it's who takes advantage of them. And I think you can say that Jobs certainly did take advantage of that and jump ahead with it. Now, only, how do people choose careers? How do they choose career paths? Well, it isn't that simple. You know, I've been in the electronic motor drive business most of my adult life. When I was a little kid, had anyone asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up? I would not have said, I want to be in the electronic motor drive business. In fact, the business didn't exist, so I certainly couldn't have said that. And a lot of us have jobs now that didn't exist when we were kids. You know, if you stop and think about that. So you couldn't have been very passionate about it because there were, how would you know about it? So how were you passionate about it? There's a great little article in the Stanford University News Service about that, how people choose career paths. And they talk about a guy named, there's a Stanford professor named John Krumbolt, and he does some studying of that as to how people choose their career paths. And it started off with his own experience. When he was a little boy, 10, he wanted to be a doctor. But there was a wreck near his house, and he saw it, and there was a compound fracture there. And when he saw the person lying on the gurney or lying out there on the ground or whatever with a compound fracture, he got nauseous. And he decided, even as a little kid, that you couldn't get nauseous at something like that and be a doctor. And he never questioned that assumption, and as a result, did not pursue a career in medicine. Now, later, as he became an adult and became a psychologist studying these kinds of motivations, he realized how silly that was. That, in fact, a lot of beginning doctors get nauseous. None of us are used to seeing broken bones sticking out of people's skin, things like that. And so it's something you have to get used to if you're going to be a doctor. But many, many doctors do overcome that and get accustomed to it. And he identifies several things that he said are self-defeating beliefs. And I'm going to share a couple of them with you when choosing a career. In the first place, he says, most people don't choose a career. They sort of just wander into it. You could almost think that about the job story I just related. He and Wozniak kind of just wandered into that. They did a great job once they got there and got it going, but they kind of just wandered into it. But here's a couple of the beliefs that he has there. He says are self-defeating beliefs. And one of them is, if I can't have the best, I don't want anything at all. That's sort of an all or nothing mentality. If I don't have everything perfect, I'm not going to do a thing. Well, then you're not going to be doing much in your life, because very few things start off with complete perfection. You have to, some people say you play the hand you're dealt, and you are going to have to play the hand you're dealt and be successful with it. Here's another one. If I don't make more money than my father, I'll consider myself a failure in life. If I fail, I feel better knowing that I had not tried very hard. And that's not something most of us are going to say, but it's true in the way we look at things. I'm not going to commit myself fully to this. So if I fail, okay, I didn't really, exhaust myself into it. That's a self-defeating prophecy. If you don't throw yourself into it, you probably will fail. I used to use the analogy when I was learning to do backward flips off of a diving board. And I remember the lady was teaching me to do this. She said, a friend of my mom, she would say, hey, look, you've got to commit before your feet leave that diving board. You don't decide, because if you only go halfway around, it's going to hurt when you hit the water. So you've got to determine before you jump that you're committed to this thing all the way. Go all the way over so your feet hit the water, not your back. And, I learned that the hard way, as so did a lot of other people. But it's the same thing in business. Going halfway into it sometimes doesn't work. I heard a speech by a guy several years ago that was a member of the Polar Bear Club up in the Great Lakes, up in the northern part of the Great Lakes. And he talked about, they go out there, you know, in the middle of winter every time, they cut a hole in the ice, and these guys jump in the ice. Don't ask me why, but it's something they do, the Polar Bear Club. You know, he made the point, he said, there's nothing to be gained whatsoever dipping your toe in that water. You already know it's cold. It's cold. Dipping your toe in there tells you nothing. That what you have to do is walk up there and jump in. And a lot of business is that way. You just have to walk up there and jump into it and do the best you can. You know, the assumption, I think, that career decisions happen naturally is a false assumption. And Crumbles, in his research, found that out. And he says that he thinks in terms of people being satisfied in a career, it's not only a big problem, it's an overlooked and unrecognized problem. This is, you know, your career decision, what you do for a living, is going to affect how you spend most of your time, most of your life. So it, at least it's something you should enter into, at least with some an informed decision of some sort to do there. And, you know, he, in his research, found out that when young people, when he's talking to college students in their decisions about careers, that a lot of people have spent more time on what shoes they're going to wear or what kind of a computer they're going to buy or what kind of car they're going to drive. They spend more time planning that than they do the careers. And consequently, this is why you have people that are so unhappy at times in their careers. They've got into jobs they did not intend to get into. They're not happy and they're not suited for. And they're miserable at doing. More to come. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Back in just a minute. Welcome back to Driven to Business. Eddie Mayfield here. We're talking about careers and your life. And right before the break, we were talking about a Stanford University professor, named Crumbolts. And he had done a little bit of study about the idea of how people choose their careers. Mainly, the primary nuance of his little article there was that people often do not choose their careers. They spend no time at all choosing it. They're guided by a lot of false premises they may employ. And, you know, one of the things he talks about, and I've seen this a lot myself, is there's the decision-making process is complicated by this idea that we all want prestigious jobs. I mean, like doctors, lawyers, professors, things of that sort. You know, that's the jobs we want. And he uses himself for an example. He says, you know, when people meet me and they find out I'm a Stanford professor, they often look up to him just because he's a Stanford professor. He said, you know, the fact is they don't know what to do. They don't know if I do a good job or a bad job. I may be the worst professor on earth. They don't know this. They just accord me some respect because I'm a Stanford professor. And he said that attitude that jobs are, you know, some jobs are worth so much more than others and jobs are just so much more prestigious goes down into children, all the way down to the children level, where, you know, and it drives perhaps some silly decision making. I noticed this even in our circle of friends and in our church and community. About people, kids getting out of high school are like standing up at graduation and particularly at church exercises and things like this, and they're going to say what they're going to do, and they're always going to these to college, and we're going to get a degree, and it'll be something pretty cool, physical therapy or sports medicine or something like that. Now, the truth of the matter is, not a lot of those kids get into those careers after they say they're going to do it. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is they haven't thought it through at all, what it takes to do that. And number two, they may find when they do get into that a little bit, they don't really like the job. And so we tend to be disdainful of some jobs. You know, for instance, I'll give you a good example. An automobile mechanic. A good automobile mechanic can make a lot of money. And if you're mechanically inclined and you enjoy working with your hands, it can be a very satisfying career. In fact, when they measure people's career happiness, a lot of hands-on trades people are as happy as anybody is out there. They're much happier than most white-collar workers. And yet, we're disdainful of those kinds of career choices. And I'll tell you what else. In today's economy, if you learn a trade and you learn to be good at that trade, and not only you just learn the trade, you learn the business of that trade. And you learn, instead of being a mechanic, you work as a while as a mechanic for somebody else, and then you open up your own automobile repair shop with other employees. You know that if you look at people like that, and it doesn't have to be a mechanic. We can be talking about a plumber, we can go to an electrician, we can talk to anybody of the trades, the carpenters, whatever, in trades like that. Their income potentials, on average, as a small business person running a nice little automobile repair shop, is the equivalent of an attorney and doctors and other things. It can be a very lucrative income, and yet because it doesn't carry this mystique, perhaps, that being a doctor carried, people, when kids are going into these careers, they tend to disdain those careers. And I think we as parents and grandparents, and just as leaders in society, and when people are talking to us about careers and we're trying to talk to them about finding fulfilling careers, we should not overlook that when you're talking to a kid. That we don't need everybody going to college and majoring in urban studies, for instance. You know, what are you going to get a job doing after you get out doing that? And that's why I think part of the reason we have such a strange unemployment situation in the country today, as a business that employs tradesmen, they're hard to find. And I'm not the only person who says that. We have a lot of people coming out of college now that don't have marketable college degrees. They're not marketable. I think in a way, colleges should be held accountable for that in some ways, for encouraging people to take majors and do things in college that they're never going to make a living. In particular, if you come out with a huge student loan debt from that, it just doesn't appear to me to be an intelligent career path to do. But again, I don't really agree with Professor Krumbholz on this. He's coined a term called occupationalism, and he equates that to sexism or racism or things like that. And he says we as a society need to quit being discriminatory about jobs like that. Now, I don't go quite that far with it, but the idea is I do go along with the fact that a good mechanic, that's an honorable profession. It is as honorable as being an attorney. It certainly is honorable. It's probably of a lot more use to society, actually, than being an attorney. The other thing, he kind of closed his little article with saying, but he had a great friend that was a clinical psychologist, a counselor, and he was a fantastic counselor that people sought out all over the country. But he did look at other things, and he saw some of his friends getting prestige, like getting on TV shows and things like that. He wasn't getting on that, although he was making a lot of money and a very successful practice. And he died of a heart attack not too long after that. And large numbers of people came to his funeral and just gave great accolades about his life, how much he had meant to them, all that. And Krumbholz was saying, you know, it was such a shame that he was disdaining his own success because he was comparing it to other folks. And we can all do that, can't we? We all relate to that, don't we? How we look at other things around us, and then we begin to be unhappy with what we do. Now, let's talk a minute about that. The idea of unhappiness, and particularly for small business people, the idea of small business burnout, and that's sort of the second half of what I was going to talk about today. We you know, a sort of a balance between choosing careers and how that's done, and at the same time, why sometimes some of us are so unhappy in the careers. Even those of us that are very entrepreneurial, and you either own or are a leader in a business or a small business especially, and how you can become so unhappy. One thing, it's never a good idea to compare yourself constantly to somebody else. You know, you can be very happy with, you got a house you really like, you and your wife really love your house, and you think it's great, and then you go to some friend's house who's got a lot nicer house, and all of a sudden you come back and your house suddenly you don't like your house. Well, what changed? Did your house morph overnight into something you hate? No, nothing happened. You just started looking at the wrong thing. And you know, that's one of those things you never catch up to. You know, the old saying of how much money's enough. Well, it's always a little more than you got. I heard a guy one time, it was a large landowner over in Alabama, had just bought another large piece of land. I actually heard this conversation. And his friends were kidding him about it. And this guy happened to be the largest landowner at that time in the state of Alabama. And his friends were kidding him about it. They said, how much land do you need, for goodness sakes? And the guy said, well, you know, he was kind of joking. He said, I just want to own the land that adjoins mine. That's all. Well, you know, the idea is you never get through that. You just keep buying land. I ran through a little bit of a downer in my own business about 2 years after its founding at EMA. You know, I had been running a company for another guy, or a department of a company, a pretty successful company. And I did a good job with that. I made decisions. I handled problems. I agonized over personnel issues. And I worked more or less independently. And I reported to the company owner. And I was held accountable for the performance of the department that I was running. I don't think I realized until leaving there how valuable that owner was to me for this reason. He required me at times to justify my decisions. And if you know, and also if we were not profitable for a month, he would ask me to justify why were we not profitable, and I'm supposed to know. And I did. I studied that. I knew those things. But you know, it was very apparent to me when I was here that I was accountable. You know, in a small business, one of the easy things to forget if you're the founder or the owner of a small business is that you are still accountable. Although you don't have a boss looking over your shoulder, you are still accountable. You're accountable to customers. You're accountable to the business. And listen, the business will fire you if you don't believe that. It will absolutely fire you. And I don't think I realized how valuable that feedback was. And that's what you miss when you don't often get immediate feedback. And so, in addition to being managed, when you're working for somebody else, you often do not see, even if you're running a department for them, you don't see the myriad of minor details that go into that business and the daily activities of running a business, the mundane things. Things like being sure the dumpster is emptied when it needs to be emptied, complying with all these various state, local, and federal laws. You have to deal with a phone company, get the phone set up. You have to deal with a power company. If you're renting a building, you got to deal with a landlord, vendors, the people you do with, and of course your customers. And you don't see that going on. And while it may seem obvious, the truth of the matter is when you begin working for yourself, those details can become overwhelming to you. And keep in mind, this has nothing to do, it may not have anything to do with your core business. It just has to do with the details. You know, getting a dumpster emptied may have nothing to do really with your business, but don't do it and watch what happens. Or, you know, if you're having a landlord wanting you to own you about something, you know, not dealing with it can get you evicted out of the place, or you got to deal with it, although it's not part of your core business. And, you know, every how-to business book I've ever read and every speech I've ever heard on this, they always stress the importance of time management. And back in the early days of our business, I would go to these things. It would always sound so easy the way they describe it, you know, the various methods. And no one really can argue about the necessity of managing your time. But I concluded a long time ago from hearing these guys that the people writing those books and making those speeches either had no real-world experience in a small business, or they worked for large multinational-type corporations where they had a lot of people to do the task. Because in real life, in a small business, if you're starting up a small or running a small, under-resourced small business, every time the telephone rings, you're going to have to answer it. You're going to stop what you're doing and answering it. And you're going to deal with whatever that phone call is about, because it might be a customer, and you've got to deal with customers. There often is no one to delegate to. And failure to pay attention to even the most mundane detail can absolutely have huge negative consequences for your business. And consequently, you've got to do all that and chase customers and perform your services and keep your products in line and all that. We're going to finish talking about that in the last segment. Today is Driven to Business. By the way, streaming live on biz1190.com. Today's program, if you missed part of it, podcast on eddiemayfield.com and iTunes. Back in a minute. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the final segment of the day's Driven to Business. We've been talking about your life and your career. We spent the first part of the program perhaps talking about how you choose careers, or how you, many of us probably do not choose them, and how we sort of walk into them probably. And I'm not disdainful of that at all. You know, I got into the business that I spent most of my adult life in. I don't want to say by accident. I kind of think the Lord kind of guides us into things, and I think He did me. But you know, I went to work. I was fortunate enough to go to work for two entrepreneurs out in Texas that were in the electronic motor drive business when it was in its infancy. So I sort of got into a growing, booming business that I didn't know much about. And the truth of the matter is, you know, when you're in a new technology, new kind of emerging business, nobody knows anything about it much. So you can really grow with everybody else. And that's what I did. And then after leaving there, you know, formed my own company, EMA Inc., here in Atlanta. By the way, you can find us at emainc.net. You can go there with sponsor of the program in electronic motor drives. Most of you don't know what those are. You can go there and read the blog pages and learn a little bit about it if you're interested. It's a great business. It's a very needed business, and I'm very glad I got into it. But it was nothing growing up I planned to be into. I was talking a little bit about the idea of my own experience. But after about 2 years of starting our company, it was beginning to burn me out a little bit. You know that there's a, you read all the time about the high failure rate of small businesses. Well, here, and really, if you'll go Google that, and what you'll find is that's a little nebulous in the way people put that, and you can never exactly get your arms around what that failure rate is. What the Small Business Administration will tell you that is not very well backed up by other research, and so you begin to look around. Here's my real life perspective on that. A lot of small businesses fail for the simple reason that the founder of that business gets tired of running it. I know a lot of people who have failed that way. In fact, you know, I have a lot of acquaintances in the small business arena. Most of them have failed either directly or indirectly because the owner or the founder got tired of running that business. It just wore him out after a while. And a lot of people do get into businesses and they it absolutely does wear them out. I was talking about the idea of time management. You know, when it's all well and good to say you should delegate things to people on time, and you know, delegate things to set. Well, you know, when if you only have one or two employees and you're all booked up to your eyeballs, who are you going to delegate that to? And it's like, well, then you have to prioritize. Well, again, in a small under-resourced company, that's hard to do when every one of those things will sink your business if they don't get done. And so after a while, that really begins to wear on people. And it requires keeping several balls in the air at once, almost all the time. And you can grow out of it. You can grow out of it. And we have in our company, as a matter of fact. But in the beginning, that can be very difficult. A lot of people don't get past that deal. And you know, at some time, I've heard a lot of people say this. They've gone to a lot of trouble to start a business, and they've been running it a couple of years. And they'll say, you know, I was better off back when I was working for so-and-so. I was making more money, and I didn't have anywhere near the headaches I've got now. So the heck with this, to let it go. One of the things you just simply have to do is set a limit on what you're prepared to give to a business of yourself. You know, you don't work yourself to death. Now, I looked up several. There have been several little blogs I like on how to avoid burnout. And this is for entrepreneurial burnout. This is not as an employee to be necessarily be burned out, but as entrepreneurial burnout. And I'm, a couple of them here, there's a thing called the Young Entrepreneurial Council. I'm not a young entrepreneur by any chance, but I stole their stuff. So we'll take a look at it. What they did was they went and quoted a bunch of people in like 15 signs of entrepreneurial burnout. I'm not going to read all of them to you. But they went to various fairly successful entrepreneurs and asked their opinion about this. I'm just going to share a couple of them with you, and it may help you. One of them was input versus output, which may not be descriptive by itself. But what it says is you're working very hard and you're draining your batteries, but you're seeing very little concrete evidence that anything's going on from the time that you're spending. You know, here's what I used to always tell people, and I would do this myself. I would set a goal for myself, and it could be in business, it'd be either a technology goal or landing in a customer or a billing goal or whatever. I used to set them for myself, and it was just for me, one for anybody else. I didn't usually tell anybody else about them. But if I hit that goal, when I hit it and I'm working toward it, I would reward myself. I say, okay, you hit that goal, you know, we're gonna get a banana split. I mean, something silly as that. But just the idea of you've accomplished something, reward yourself for it. And maybe you have much higher taste than I do, the banana split. But the idea of just reward yourself little small increments as you go along and make these achievable that you can see them. You can see the goal and make a list. I've always been a big fan of to-do lists. You make a to-do list in the morning and you sit down and you accomplish. And you know, one thing that having a to-do list does, if you end up writing down 48 things, you can say, well, I can't do 48 things today. Well, then you start prioritizing and say, okay, this doesn't really have to be done. 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 And you can do it. But that's one of the signs of entrepreneurial burnout is, in fact, if you are not seeing results from your hard work, you're working very hard and you're seeing no dealer. You know, another thing, and this is so prevalent in today, and I find this with myself, I find this with everybody. If you're spending too much time on Twitter, Facebook, and whatever else you use for a, if you find that you are doing that instead of doing your work, it probably means you are approaching burnout in your work. You know, it's the, it goes where you at one time were very excited to come to work and do your business, and now you are sort of beat down by it, and you kind of don't want to face it, but you don't want to tell anybody that. So you sort of just, you know, you make your day very busy where you're busy. You know, you can spend all day long on social media and accomplish nothing. And it has this strange attraction of looking like you're doing something. Not focusing, an inability to focus. You know, there's a saying that I love. It said, if a man chases two rabbits, both of them get away. One of the things can burn you out is if you are not focusing. It's so, think of it this way. The analogy I use is if you've got a dirty house and you're coming in to clean your house and you look at the house and you're like, oh man, this is beyond me. I can't do this. Well, the way to get that done is don't concentrate in the whole house. Pick out a room. Pick the kitchen. You say, you know, I'm going to clean the kitchen. If the kitchen's too dirty, I'm going to clean off this couch or off this desk. Or make it something you can actually, and when you finish that job, something has been done. Now, you can apply that to your work, too. Focus on things at work that you can get done and do them and see the end results of them. And you will find that it will be inspiring to you. Success breeds success, even small success, which I was telling you before about rewarding yourself for small successes. And, you know, one of the rewards just can be that area that was messed up is not messed up now, or that little project you had to do, that marketing project, is now done. The brochure you were trying to design, and you're trying to redo all your sales literature, but you just can't quite get it done. Well, concentrate on one piece of your sales literature, if you're using literature, or whatever you're doing. Get it done so that at the end of your time expended, you see some results. Another sign, at least for me, of burnout is an inability to sleep. And I don't normally have to sleep. I normally don't have problems. But if you find yourself tossing and turning and unable to let things go, it's a sign you have too much on your plate. That's what it's a sign of. And it's a dangerous self-fulfilling cycle. You can't get to sleep because your mind's too active, and then you're going to be even more tired the next day. Anyway, it's great being in business. It really is. It's wonderful. I encourage anybody. It's such a what a great thing in this country that we can have our own businesses. Just enter it wisely, work it wisely, get some help, and as the Ricky Skaggs song says, enjoy the ride. You've been listening to Driven to Business. See you guys next week. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Bye.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.